Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am really, really excited to have with me today one of my graduating residents who has been just such a superstar these past 3 years. I'm sad that she's leaving, but excited that she's staying here to do a pediatric anesthesia fellowship. Dr. Alexis Motes, she is just an incredible person, incredible physician. She has two wonderful children. She's been the president of our social media committee here during her residency and has done such an incredible job with that. If you've ever checked out our Instagram page, you'll know how amazing the work she's done is. And we thought it'd be really fun to talk about some of the reflections that she has about her time in residency that aren't really specific necessarily to Hopkins, but are really things that we both thought would be helpful to anyone out there who's either a medical student thinking about residency, a resident who's going through it right now, or even folks in practice who are reflecting back on their own residency, and would be fun to hear what someone who's been super successful thought about and did during the course of her residency. And then we'll also talk a little bit about social media, how that's playing a role in recruitment and retention and in the decisions people are making about which programs to rank and programs about which applicants to rank. So lots of really exciting stuff. And I couldn't be more thrilled to have with me Dr. Alexis Motes. Alexis, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jed. You can't see me shaking my head back here on the podcast, but that was a very lovely introduction. You're the best program director that a resident could ask for. And I'm so happy to talk with everybody today about my experience here.
Awesome. So happy. So let's start by talking a little bit about you. Tell the audience as much or as little as you'd like about kind of who you are, how you got here, and what do you think is important in terms of them knowing about you?
Sure. So like you said, my name is Alexis Motes. I was born and raised in the Midwest. I'm from South Dakota, which is a real state that actually exists. I went to undergrad in Atlanta, Georgia. So I had been to the East Coast before, but I've really lived all over the place growing up in many different places because my dad was in medical training when I was a kid. I did my intern year outside of Maryland. I actually went to Arizona to get sort of a different experience, which is a very cool thing that you have offered here at Hopkins, where now we can do an intern year here, which is fabulous if you don't want to move twice, but you also still have the opportunity to go somewhere else. And then I came to Baltimore having never stepped foot here a single time. We actually got our house before we even moved here. And have been here for 3 years and have absolutely been blown away by how much we love it here. Not just Hopkins, which we love. My daughter calls it Hopskins, but just the city of Baltimore as well.
That's awesome. And so your children are now 7 and 5, is that right?
7 and 5, yep.
So you really were through it with young kids during residency. It is amazing how impressive it is, you and others who have done it, to have gone through residency while raising young children. And your kids are an absolute delight, so well done on all fronts.
Thank you. They are absolutely my greatest accomplishment, and I got very lucky. They're very good kids.
Awesome. So let's talk a little bit about your thoughts on what it takes to be successful in residency. I can verify for sure that you have been incredibly successful. So what do you think, reflecting back, gets into how you're successful? And I guess part of that is also, how do we think about measuring success? What makes someone successful, both personally and professionally? Tell us your thoughts on that.
Absolutely. So I think that the thing that is very important in residency, first and foremost, is that you're going to get out what you put in. The base amount of effort it takes to be a resident is high. There's long hours. You're going to be in the OR. You're going to be putting the time in. But just because you're physically in the hospital doesn't mean that you're mentally in the hospital. There's going to be days where it's harder to do this than others. But really showing up every single day and wanting to squeeze out every single ounce of information that you can get is going to be the most important thing, I think, to be successful. This doesn't mean that you have to show up at 100% every single day. I think that would be impossible. But it does mean that on the days that you can, on the days that you feel good, really, really, really put the effort into getting something out of it. And one of the other things I think you can keep in mind is a lot of the times, especially as a CA1, I remember feeling really overwhelmed by the situations that I was in. And sometimes it was like, how can I possibly be understanding what's going on? And I will say that if you put the effort into just absorbing what you can by watching other people, picking a task and getting really good at it, like if you're in a big trauma MTP and you just really dive into checking in blood, that is an actually valuable skill to have, and you'll come out better because of it. And so it doesn't mean that you always have to know every single nuanced, you know, physics principle or physiologic principle of this big case that you're doing, but getting anything you can is going to make you successful. I will say as well that I think one of the things that helps set you up for success in residency is making a good first impression. It's, I think, pretty difficult to outgrow a really bad first impression. I think you can absolutely do it. But I think that if you really show up at the beginning and try to throw yourself in there, it doesn't matter if you miss your IVs. It doesn't matter if you miss your intubations. It doesn't matter if you don't know the answers to questions. But if you show up willing to learn and wanting to be there, that is what is going to make the difference in how people perceive you. And they're going to want to give you information and want to teach you in the OR if you give that impression. And that's going to follow you all the way to the end.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, a cardiac surgeon told me once that he used to tell all his trainees, it's overwhelmingly not balanced. In other words, what matters the most, he was saying, for a cardiac surgeon's career are the first couple years. If you do really well in the first couple years, then if you make some mistakes down the road, people will just be like, oh, this is a great surgeon who had a bad day. But if you make a bunch of mistakes and don't work hard and don't try hard early on, people are going to think you're not a hardworking surgeon. And then even if you have great outcomes later, they're going to be like, oh, that was a fluke. So the reputation you establish at the beginning, and this absolutely applies, as you said, to residency, is really, really important. I couldn't agree more. I also think that what you said about coming to work whenever possible, thinking I'm going to put everything I can into this, is so key. And we've just been orienting, of course, our new residents. We're recording this at the very end of June. And I have said to them, and I say every year, don't see this as a barrier to overcome. If you see residency as a barrier to overcome, then you will just do the minimum to get through it. That's what anyone would do to a barrier. You just want to overcome it. You don't care how high over it you get, as long as you get over it. But if you see residency as an opportunity to get the most out of it that you can, not only learning about anesthesia, but also building relationships with your colleagues, developing a reputation as a professional amongst the people around you, that is going to be something that will lead you to get the most out of it, as you said. So that's hugely important. And then I also love that you said kind of, you know, if you're feeling overwhelmed, especially early on when you will feel overwhelmed a lot, don't let that make you just go to a corner and do nothing. Because if you just pick a piece, like you said, checking in blood, it could be, say, I will get the A-line or I will put in an IV and just focus on that. If you know, when you're a CA3, then you really need to be able to get the whole picture and start delegating and running the show. As a CA1, if you just say, I will put the IV in, and you do that, you're going to be seen as someone who really helped in the moment. And that allows you to tackle it even when the whole thing seems overwhelming. And it should seem overwhelming. A huge trauma, a huge crashing patient, that should seem overwhelming as a CA1. And so don't worry about being able to get it all under control. That's not your job. You should be able to pick something and tackle it, as you said, Alexis, and that is huge. How do you think residents kind of can feel personally successful, especially, you know, residents like you who have a lot going on? You're a partner to your husband, you are a mom to your children, and you're a resident. That's a lot.
So I think that this is something that can be really hard. And I like to think of residency more like diet and exercise than it is like taking an exam. So when you really want to get fit and healthy and get a six pack, which I will never have, and I'm so okay with that, you're not going to see the results from 2 weeks of lifting weights. But after a year, you're going to see a change. And one of the things that I felt very good about when I tried to reflect on personal success was looking at the people who are coming after me and thinking, you know, look how far I've come. I really liked doing that by throwing myself into education. So if I am able to teach something, it helps me feel like I'm successful at that thing. And it also helps me get better at that thing as well. I think that one of the ways that you can measure success tangibly every day is not necessarily just attending feedback or did you get the IV, but we're all here to take care of patients. And so when you drop your patients off in the PACU and they're alive and they're okay, and alive and okay is a great baseline for a CA1, you can feel good about that going home. Even if you gave them 3 poke marks and they've got a bunch of Band-Aids on their arm, they were safe and you got them through surgery. And that is a big moment in their life. They are almost certainly not medical. They have been thinking about this for weeks to months, and you were there for them when they needed you to be. And that is success. And being able to take a look at that every day, even if you had a bad day in the OR, seeing your patient at the end of the day, I think is a good daily reflection on what success means. And then celebrating when you get the win. You mentioned just saying, I'm going to get the IV in these big traumas. And I will never forget when I was a CA1, we had this huge GSW trauma patient, and my CA3 had me put in the IV and I got it. And it was a big 18, which I thought was super big at the time. And at the end of the case, we had done a massive transfusion, and she looked at me and she said, Alexis, that IV saved that patient's life. Congratulations. That was a great job. And I really did basically nothing else for the entirety of that 6-hour case other than check in blood. But knowing that that IV saved her life was a really profound moment for me to say, okay, even the little things are really important. Okay. So overall, thinking, you know, you will be successful. I promise the process works. But day to day, those are some little things to think about.
And what a great example of leadership by that CA3, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're in the midst of trying to deal with all that's going on with this massive trauma. And, you know, to you, getting an IV is no longer a big deal, right, if you're that CA3. But that person had the wherewithal to think to themselves, you know, this CA1 just did this, and I want to make sure that I take a minute out of the craziness to tell her, hey, what you just did mattered. And that's huge. You remember it 3 years later, right?
I sure do.
It made a big difference. So that's a great example of leadership. What do you think? And obviously, this is kind of a funny thing to ask you, but what do you think program directors are looking for, or how we measure success in our residents?
I think that's a really interesting question, and I probably have changed my opinion on what I believed you thought was success from a CA1 to a CA3. I think now, reflecting back on all of residency, I think program directors are just looking for residents who want to be good doctors. And we sort of talked about this at the beginning, but people who show up and they want to learn, they want to get something from this program, and they want to leave it better than how they found it. I think that you can absolutely be a good doctor and a successful person if you come into a good program and you do the minimum. Like if you come into Johns Hopkins and you phone it in, you're still going to be a very good anesthesiologist at the end. I do believe that. But I don't think that it means that you're going to necessarily be viewed as the most successful or the most contributing to the residency program. And so I have zero doubt that you have no idea how many IVs or intubations I've missed, which is what I thought mattered as a CA1. I thought you were all in a room somewhere discussing how many times I goosed it, right? But now I know that what you're looking for is the effort, and you're looking for people who just want to leave something better than when they came.
Yeah, that's right on. And you know, this happened the other day, and it always kills me when I'm working with a resident and they miss whatever, the IV, the A-line, the intubation. Not because I care, but because I can see in their eyes that they are so distraught that they're working with their program director and they've missed it. And I think it's because you're right. What they think is, this is what he's judging me on. And it couldn't be more wrong. And I always say in the moment, not only am I not disappointed or upset, I'm actually really glad this happened, because it means this was a challenging line or a challenging airway. And that's what I want. I want you to have challenging airways, right? Especially with me, so I can help you with them. And then we can both learn. You're exactly right that it doesn't matter. I mean, you know, we've never, ever, ever had someone who gets to CA3 year and can't put an IV in, or can't put an A-line in, or can't intubate. So that's not an issue. But you're right. The best residents are not the ones who have a higher percentage of A-line hitting. They're the residents who are showing up in all the ways you've talked about. They're working hard. They're helping their colleagues. They're stepping up as a team player. They are clearly wanting to get every ounce of learning out of this that they can and help others do the same, as well as make a difference in their patients' lives. And what you said about patients is really key. It's easy sometimes, and I think this is a shame, in the craziness of training and all the time that you're spending in the hospital, and unfortunately a lot with computers, to forget that at baseline, what we're doing is taking care of people and making a huge difference in their lives. It's hard, I think, a little bit as an anesthesiologist because we don't usually get like thank you notes from our patients. And so that would be an easy reminder if we got those all the time. But it doesn't mean we're not doing it. And it's a real blessing, I think, to feel like we get to spend our hours and days making a difference in people's lives and sometimes saving those lives. And so we shouldn't forget that.
Absolutely. 100%. That's the job.
So we talked about days being hard. Often days as a doctor are hard. Certainly days as a resident are hard. You, I'm sure, have had days you've been discouraged, but you often are smiling, happy. I've even seen some of your Instagram posts where you're, you know, biking home after a 28-hour call and you're exhausted, obviously, but you're also don't seem discouraged. So how do you get through the tough days and residency in general without being discouraged too often?
Yeah, I think that this has been a learning process for me, and early on is much harder than it is when you find what makes you tick, what you find what makes you happy. I think really important for the beginning residents out there is that you cannot let failures start to drown you. I came into residency with a lot of experience with procedures. Just by nature of being at a rural hospital, I did a lot of procedures before I came. But that didn't mean that I didn't miss stuff. And I felt really bad and I was really hard on myself when I did miss stuff. I felt like, oh, I'm better than this. I remember specifically, I had a SLU where I just couldn't put an IV in my CA1 year. I just couldn't do it. And it wasn't because I didn't have the skill. I had gotten so in my head about it that every single movement was so hyper-analyzed. And I remember I had an attending who isn't here anymore, but who was a lovely guy who just looked at me and said, you have to stop this. You cannot let this missing of an IV keep affecting you. You have to shake it off. And that was really direct feedback that I really needed. And I really took it to heart. And ever since then, I know that when I miss something, it's an opportunity to do it better the next time. And not because I have better skills, but because I know what not to do. And I've learned so many things having that mentality of saying, okay, I did this wrong this time, so now I know to not do it that way, and that's great. And viewing those things as a learning experience has been so helpful to having the hard days feel better. I also think that it's really important to remember that now as a CA3, I can promise you that the process works. I am not sure I ever thought that I would get to the place where I feel like I can look at a patient and I know I will get a tube in whatever hole somebody needs me to put it in. You will get better. You will get smarter. You will get faster just by showing up to work every day. And I think one of the things that's, people say it's really hard to have kids in medical training. I think that's true. But I think that having an outlet at home that takes you outside of the hospital mentality is really important. And I'm not advocating for everybody to go out and have a baby or to find one and bring it to your home. But I am saying that find something that you can have as an outlet, whether it's baking, playing the piano, reading, exercising. I do advocate for exercising despite not exercising. All sorts of things that you can have that do not involve sitting in your home, reflecting on the last 12 hours of your life and getting you outside of that mentality is going to be really important.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I love the part about trusting the process. It's hard. And I think that I say this, of course, to the new CA1s every year, that we all come to medicine from having done really well at things in our lives, right? We must have done well in undergrad to get into a good medical school and done well in medical school to get into this residency, or really these days to get into any anesthesia residency. And so you're used to being good at things. And then when you're new at anesthesia, you're not good. And what's interesting is that for some people, and maybe for a fair number of people, you don't feel the incremental improvement. So it could be 6 months into CA 1 year, and in your mind, you haven't improved at all. You're still at the baseline. Now, we can all see that that's not true, but you may not be able to. And so I always tell the CA1s, if you're feeling that, first of all, obviously talk to somebody. Come talk to me, talk to someone who you're comfortable talking to. And I would encourage everybody out there, talk to your program director, talk to your mentors about that if you're feeling that way. But also, you will be so much better off if you can trust that you are improving and that the process works. No program out there is routinely graduating people who don't know how to do anesthesia. You will get there. And if not before, then the time where it will be so clear to you how far you've come is when the new CA1 start the next year.
Yep.
And you will see, and you said this earlier, right, that seeing the people come behind you was one way you felt like, wow, I really can see how much I've grown. And that is so true, that you see the new trainees who were you a year ago and you think, wow, I've come a long way. And so you really do, if you can just, and it's hard. Most of us are not the type of personality that can let go really easily. Mm-hmm. But if you can just give yourself a little grace and say, I'm going to trust that this program is going to get me where I need to go, and I don't have to stress about it every step of the way, you're going to be happier.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then an outlet at home for sure. I mean, I'm with you, my kids through, I had, when I started CA 1 year, I had a 3-day-old and then a year and a half later had another baby. So, you know, and that sounds exhausting, and it was, but also it was such a blessing. And I felt like when I would come home to those screams of daddy, daddy, and those giant hugs, you know, everything else went away. It doesn't matter how stressful the day was.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm sure there are substitutes, as you said, for babies, right? It could be good friends. It could be a hobby. But you should absolutely make sure you're something you're loving doing that is unrelated to work. I agree with that.
For sure.
What have been some of the biggest challenges that you have faced, Alexis, during your residency?
I think, once again, this is something that's really interesting to think about from the perspective of a CA3 instead of a CA1. At the beginning, the most challenging part was everything. It was all the procedures. It was all of the, you know, lines, intubations, learning how to just empty a Foley. I remember being talked through at excruciating detail how to empty a Foley because I just couldn't figure it out. And now looking back, I think that the biggest challenge has actually been finding your voice in the OR. It can be really tricky, especially I think as an anesthesiologist, to understand when to speak up, how to speak up, and to not feel in a position of lower hierarchy in the operating room, especially as a resident. But when you're sitting in the room without an attending present and something is happening and you need to communicate it to the surgical staff, figuring out how to do that in a way that advocates for the patient, doesn't make you seem like a jerk, but gets the message across is really tricky. And I think it has been one of the biggest sources of growth for me is I feel able to walk into the OR now and be confident and I can speak up. But that's a skill that I think is really challenging for a lot of residents, having now done a lot of education as part of residency. And so that is probably one of the things that's sort of a hidden part of anesthesia that's challenging.
And how do you help like junior residents who are struggling with that? Do you give them certain phrases to use? What do you tell them to do to improve?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that we didn't mention, I was a SIM fellow this year. So I did an education essentially fellowship during my CA3 year. And so I got to do one-on-one feedback with all the CA1s. And this is something specifically that I talked about because I think it's so important. I don't know if any of you out there have seen the show Bluey, but in Bluey, there is a little tiny baby dog who is getting, who's playing with her dad, and her dad's being a little too rough. And she gets kind of sad by the end of the day because she hasn't been able to tell her dad that he was being a little too rough because her older sister thought it was fine. And what they talk about in the show is that she needs to learn how to use her big girl bark. And so I talk to all the residents about finding your big girl bark in the OR. And it doesn't mean that you are mean. It doesn't mean that you are upset. It doesn't mean that you are critical of whatever they're doing in the surgery. But it means that you find a way to get the confidence in yourself to use literally a louder voice. If you don't have a loud voice, it can be something as easy as pulling down the OR curtain. Maybe it's tapping your hand on the table just to get people's attention. Because if this is a very good example that I use every time, when you insufflate and the patient gets bradycardic, the surgeon doesn't have the ears to hear the pulse ox. Sometimes they do, but at, I would say 95% of the time, nobody's listening to the beeps except you, who are the beep master. And so literally practicing in the mirror or practicing with a friend saying, hey, we have bradycardia. Can you desufflate the abdomen? Or, guys, the heart rate is a problem. We need to desufflate. However you want to say it, a way that puts the patient first, gives you the ability to speak louder, and to get people's attention is really, really important. And as you do bigger and bigger cases, the problems become bigger and bigger. And if you can't communicate things like bradycardia and insufflation, you're not going to be able to communicate the patient coding during reperfusion in a liver.
Yeah, absolutely. So well said. And I love the part about patient first, because I think for a lot of people, they just don't feel comfortable kind of inserting themselves and kind of being like, okay, I need attention right now.
Yeah.
But you're exactly right. That's not what you're saying. You're saying the patient needs attention right now. And so phrases that I think can be really helpful are things like the ones you said are perfect. You can also say, I'm worried about the patient, or I'm concerned about the patient, right?
One of the things that I say to get people's attention is, we have a safety issue. And when you use the word safety, people start to have their ears perk up a little bit.
Absolutely. And you know, people may be listening and semi-rolling their eyes and thinking like, oh, I don't need to practice that. But I would say, actually, unless you know that you say this stuff all the time and you're good at it, practicing, just like practicing anything else, is really key. I would encourage you to get in front of a mirror and say these things out loud.
100%.
And then envision yourself being in the OR, saying them out loud. Visualize it. Just like you would if you've ever played a sport and you would visualize yourself, you know, in baseball hitting the ball, or in tennis hitting the ball, or whatever it is. You know, my daughter plays lacrosse and she visualizes her dodges and her shots. This is key. Visualize yourself in a stressful situation in the OR having to say these phrases out loud and then say them out loud, and that will make a big difference.
One of the things that I will say, which is kind of a CA3 level tip, is people don't know what ventilators are. You think they do, they do not. And something that can be really helpful if you're having a ventilator issue, because you will, something will get unplugged, is if you use the word life support machine, people suddenly care a lot about what's going on your side of the drape. And so instead of saying the ventilator bellows are collapsing and they're not refilling again, nobody knows what you're talking about, and they have no idea how severe of an issue it is. So saying something like, everybody, the life support machine isn't functioning, they will suddenly care a lot and decide to help you. So that's another thing that's just a little trick that you can use to help people understand your job.
That's awesome. I love it. All right. Let's talk about how you prioritize wellness and balance all your various obligations that we've talked about while still finding a way to maintain that wellness throughout. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hey, folks, if you've ever been listening to a patient's heart and lungs in pre-op and wondering if there's some mild wheezing or a faint murmur, you are not alone. I used to struggle with this all the time until I got my echo. Honestly, listening through an echo is like night and day compared to a regular stethoscope. That's because Echo's digital stethoscope amplifies heart and lung sounds up to 40 times, and there's noise cancellation to cut out distractions. I can't emphasize enough how amazing it is when you can hear so clearly. And you can unlock murmur and AFib detection powered by Echo AI, along with sound recording and sharing for earlier diagnosis as well. Echo is backed by 4 million heart sounds and 8 FDA clearances for devices and AI algorithms. Those who use it are 2 times more likely to detect heart disease. I can't tell you how much better I can hear hearts and lungs in every area that I work with my Echo. I trust Echo so much that I worked with their team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/ACRAC. Your purchase is HSA and FSA eligible and may qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you'll detect heart and lung conditions more confidently. If you don't, return it for a full refund. Go to echohealth.com/ACRAC for $50 off plus a free chest piece cover. That's ekohealth.com/ACCRAC. Hey, folks, I want to dive deeper into something that I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers, FIGS scrubs. Made for awesome humans, these are scrubs that have our needs in mind. They're durable, antimicrobial, and super comfortable, which matters when you're 10 hours into your shift. I love my FIGS, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves her so much that she's all FIGS all the time. That's all she wears to work ever since COVID. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, an anesthesiologist like me, or even a med student starting out. Investing in a couple pairs of FIGS is totally worth it. We're partnering with Figs to get you 15% off your first purchase when you use code FIGSRX at wearfigs.com. And Figs goes beyond scrubs, too. They've got shoes, under scrubs, and even jackets that will make the ever-present hospital AC seem like a thing of the past. And they come in a wide range of colors that will let your personality shine through. With back-to-school season upon us, it's the perfect time to stock up with some fresh outfits for the year. And Figs just dropped a brand new collection of limited edition styles and accessories. If you're in healthcare or shopping for someone who is, you can get 15% off your first order at wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX. All right, and we're back with Dr. Motes talking about how she has maintained wellness in residency.
I think that you have to actively choose it. It is not going to find you. We've had a lot of really difficult things happen during my time in residency, and there has been times where I have not chosen to be well. I don't like saying that wellness is a choice. If you have a mental health issue, if you have depression, you're not going to be able to choose wellness. If you have crippling anxiety and panic attacks, you are not going to be able to choose wellness for yourself. But I do think that if you choose things that help you be well outside the hospital, you are going to be better able to cope with the inevitable challenging days that you have. So just like we talked about before, having an outlet is super, super important. I cannot say this enough. You cannot just be an anesthesia resident for the next 3 years of your life. I call it the case of the some days, where people say, someday I will do this. Someday I will travel. Someday I will start baking again. Someday I'll start reading again. Because they don't feel like being a resident is an actual time of living your life. I didn't have the luxury of being able to do that because my kids are going to get older no matter what I do, and they're going to want me to play toys with them. So that maybe comes a little bit easier. But if you have the mentality that your life is going to start after residency, you could not be more wrong. And one of the other things I want to advocate for is having people you know you can call. At this program, it is very easy because I know that I could pick up the phone at 2 a.m. and call Jed Wolpa and he would answer and he would help with whatever I needed. If you're at a program where that maybe you don't feel comfortable with that, your co-residents are going to be your biggest advocates because they know what you're going through. They're going through the same things, and finding people that you know that you can call is really important. So I think those are the two things: making sure you have something outside the OR so you can choose to do that outside the OR, not letting it fall away, not letting it be something you're going to do someday, and then having people you can call when things are hard.
Yeah, that's really important. And I just want to be clear, and I know you mean this, that, you know, cutting, so the 5 extra minutes you get by, you know, not checking in with your colleague who's maybe having a bad day or offering a break to somebody who you think hasn't had a break so that you get out, you know, 5, 10, 15 minutes earlier, that's probably not going to make a big difference to your wellness, even if in your mind, and I only say this because I remember doing it as a resident, I'm thinking in my head, well, if I get out right now, then I can make it to the gym and still get home in time for this and that, right? And so it seems to you like actually that 15 minutes is going to make or break your whole plan for the evening.
Yeah.
But I would say that actually much more important than that is the way you will feel about yourself and the reputation you will know you have if you do give that break to that colleague. Because over time, first of all, you will be seen as someone who is there for their colleague, someone who is a reliable, caring team player. You'll know you're seen that way. And the satisfaction and fulfillment that brings is huge for wellness. So I think, well, absolutely. Like, you need to have the stuff at home. And when you have a day off, you need to, you know, take advantage of it and not just lay around all day. And, you know, if you get out early and you do have time, you should do all the things. But don't fall into the trap of thinking that every opportunity to get out a few minutes early, I should take it rather than maybe check in with a colleague or make sure everybody's okay. Because, you know, we just had a meeting where I read these shout outs to the residents from the residents. And what strikes me every time is there are so many of them and they're so wonderful, and they're not like, oh, I couldn't get the A-line and Alexis came in and did it and she's so good at A-lines. It's she, you know what, Alexis was post-call and she was on her way out and she saw that I was struggling to set up my room and she stayed an extra 20 minutes and helped me, and oh my God, it changed the day for me and I'm so grateful. And that is, you know, don't forget, all of you out there, how meaningful that is, not just for that person, but for you too.
I think that is absolutely true. I think that if you have the ability to stay and help, you are going to feel really good about yourself. We all learn this in kindergarten. We gradually forget it along the way, but helping others is very rewarding. And that's not to say that if you've had a really terrible day or your kid is puking at home, by all means, take the 15 minutes and go home. But the times that you can stay, he's absolutely correct. It will make a big difference and it will make you feel better. And it will also make you feel like you're not stuck at the hospital. I think if you're constantly trying to escape, you're going to feel like this is a jail. If this is a place where you want to be, because you know you're going to have friends, you're going to help each other, you're going to learn, that's going to also contribute to just helping you feel better in general.
Yep, totally agree. Often as a resident, and always, you know, beyond, but certainly as a resident, you feel really tired. You're tired. You've worked long hours. You maybe haven't gotten a lot of sleep. How do you deal with that in a productive way?
I think this is one of the more challenging parts of residency is the fact that you're tired all the time. We have a particularly challenging ICU rotation where you just don't sleep very often, especially certain attendings who are on require you to be awake more hours of the day. One of the things that my dad, who is an emergency medicine physician, told me before I started residency was eat when you can and sleep when you can. I think that is absolutely good advice if you haven't heard it before. I think a lot of times people can fall into the trap of, oh, this is my time. Now that I'm outside the hospital, I gotta, you know, catch up on all this social media stuff. I need to finish this show. I need to read this book, because they feel like they're grasping for time that's been taken away from them. I think there is something really great about going to bed. If you are somebody who goes to bed at 8 p.m., do not feel like you are missing out on life. You will be able to take the day, the next day, by the horns, right? And be able to participate more in what's going on than if you stayed up super late watching TikToks and scrolling on your phone. I personally struggled a lot with this CA 1 year, where you spend long hours here and they're so exhausting that you just want your brain to sort of shut off. I promise if you just lay down in bed and turn off the lights, you will go to sleep. And you're going to feel so much better. So I very much so advocate for just going to bed when you can. And if you are tired at the hospital, tell somebody. If you are falling asleep in the OR, they will find a way to help you. I can count on one hand the time that I was tired enough to fall asleep at the hospital. And it was one time, and it was the middle of the night. And I text my CA3 and I was like, I got to get out of here. And they were like, oh yeah, absolutely. Nobody's going to think bad about you if you advocate for yourself as well.
Yeah. And nobody wants a resident who's falling asleep to be in the OR taking care of a patient.
Nope.
So, you know, everybody's on the same page. Now, if you're falling asleep every time you're in the OR, that's a problem and you need some help, but you should still ask for help because we have to get you that help. But yes, absolutely. If you've just had a rough stretch and you're really tired, I really feel confident that there is not a program director out there who would say, if you come to me and say, I'm falling asleep in the OR and I need some help, that they would think of you as having failed. They will be impressed that you were willing to come forward, whether it's to them, to the chiefs, to whoever, and say, hey, like, you know, I'm really sorry, but I just think this isn't safe right now and I need some help. They will help you. That's the right thing to do. In fact, knowing when to call for help, knowing when to ask for help is a strength, not a weakness. And that should be the message we are sending to everybody.
100%. I wish I had learned that sooner, but I learned it pretty quick here.
Yeah.
You guys ingrain it into us. Ask for help if you need it.
I absolutely hope so. So we've talked about some things you found rewarding, but what else? What have you found to be some of the most rewarding pieces of the time you've spent over the past 3 years as a resident?
I think this program is really special in the friendships that you make with your co-residents, and hopefully this is true everywhere, but I can just advocate for here that I have never had as good of friends as I have had with these colleagues. We take care of each other. We advocate for each other. We have birthday parties. We go on trips. We have just become really invaluable friends, and that is so important to me, and it has made the time here go by quickly and go by in a way that makes me so happy to look back and see what we've accomplished together. I think, like we talked about before, standing here sort of at the top of the mountain and looking back, seeing how far I have come, seeing that the process really does work, is so rewarding. I mean, I cannot believe how much different I am as a person now than I was as a CA1. And it's not bad things. It's, I am so much more confident. I know that I am good at anesthesia. I know that this is the job that I was meant to do. I know that all of the friends and the attending friends that I have who are now my colleagues, you know, who have cheered me on along the way, I feel like I can stand next to them and think, yeah, I'm good at this. And that is so rewarding. And I cannot believe that I can say that. One of the things that this program specifically does really well is gives you graduated autonomy. And as you become a CA3, you take call where you're coordinating the entire hospital worth of residents overnight, and you're posting cases, you're starting cases, you're extubating cases, you're helping take care of CRNAs and get them out on time. And watching myself be able to go from super overwhelmed to showing up, you know, a couple days ago was my last call, and I walked in, I knew it was all going to be fine. I got everybody out. We all went home. All the patients were alive. That is really rewarding. And first and foremost, part of our job is taking care of patients. And just like I said before, being able to follow up on some of these patients who were really, really sick, and I did a really good job taking care of them, and being able to say, you did a good job. I think not enough people say, yeah, I crushed it. Look at how well this patient is doing. That has been so rewarding. And so I encourage you to follow up on some of your more difficult patients and see how well they're doing now. And just congratulate yourself on a job well done.
So, so important. I completely agree. We talked about this earlier, but we do forget sometimes that, you know, when a patient, some, there are cases where when the patient is alive at the end, that is because of the job we did.
Mm-hmm.
That's an amazing thing. And we should take a moment to just say, like you said, to say, wow, good job, me. I mean, I saved a life.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
For sure.
And, you know, you can't say that in, certainly can't say it in every career, and you can't even say it in every specialty in medicine, but anesthesia is one of them where we really do that. And it's a big deal.
Yeah. And I think also, you know, one of the things that has also been really rewarding for me, and we talked about it sort of at the beginning, is I have been the president of the social media committee for 2.5 years. I sort of took up the mantle halfway through my CA 1 year because I really loved looking at the Instagram as a resident applicant and then as an intern, because it helped me feel so connected to everybody. It helped me feel like I knew what was going on. I felt like I was a part of it. And that was really, really important to my own journey. And I wanted to be able to do that when the person stepped down. So even though I was just a baby, I took it on, and it has been so rewarding to be able to show everybody what this program is about, because I love it so much and I am so happy to be able to show people what it's about. And it has given me so much satisfaction to see the growth. I'll toot my own horn and say we started my tenure as the social media committee as like we had 2,000, 3,000 followers, and we now have over 9,000 followers. That's a anime reference for all of you people out there who know what I just said. But I think that's because we've done a really good job of making it authentic. I say we, cause there's, you know, a whole team behind it. But it has been also just one of the most rewarding parts for me about being here.
Well, you've done an amazing job with it, much better than I could ever have done or imagined. And it's been really fun to watch it grow and to watch you take that leadership role and really run away with it. I'd love to talk a little bit about kind of what do we know about social media use in terms of who's using it, who's paying attention. I mean, that 9,000 followers for a residency account is, seems shocking. So what do we know? Who's using this? What role is it playing? What are they looking at? What do we know?
Yeah, so I think that when I personally recognized how important it was to me, I knew that there had to be some sort of, you know, collection of people out there who also believed it was as important as I thought it was. And I think that it's maybe a little bit more challenging for maybe the older generation of physicians to think, oh, this is just a silly thing that people are doing on social media. And it's not important. And I will caution you against that mentality, because the data is showing that it's actually extremely important. especially after 2020, when people couldn't be in person for interviews, a lot of programs started doing studies about the use of social media in resident recruitment, and even match rates for different programs. And so I think a bunch of the sources that I'll talk about here are going to be listed in the show notes, but some of the data that I found just, you know, in a couple of weeks looking into this was 65% of resident applicants said that they used social media to view programs. This is, you know, probably a very small sample size, and I'm confident that that number is higher than 65%. Instagram was the most common thing that people looked at, followed by X. The X platform has sort of dropped off in importance, especially over the last 3 years. Instagram was by far and away, I mean, 70-80+% of what people were looking at. And one of the things that I thought was relevant and really hit home onto what I've tried to do is that applicants weren't using it to view call schedules or to view OR cases. They're using it to try to get a feel for the culture, for the camaraderie that you experience, and what sort of wellness programs are available. Things that performed really well were faculty interactions. And so it's not just showing a bunch of residents, you know, out at a party. It's what are you doing in the OR? Do your faculty like being with you? Do they like teaching you? Are you having good interactions with them? And I think like those are just really basic data to start, but I think it's really impactful.
Yeah. I mean, there's no question. And I would say that I agree with you, that 65% number is probably low, or at least I bet the number is much higher among the most kind of savvy competitive applicants, because with the people we're interviewing, almost all will say, you know, I loved your Instagram. I saw, you know, the video that you guys post on Instagram. So people are paying attention to this, and I think it's making a big difference. What kind of influence do we know? Is there any data on the kind of, you know, so people are looking at it, but like, does it actually matter in terms of how they're picking who to apply to, who to, or even who to rank?
Yeah, it actually does. So the data for a couple years ago says that 50% of applicants say that social media influenced their impression of a program. And then they went further into the question and said, did this impact how you ranked programs? 25 to 30% said it affected their rank list. So a third of residents are looking at social media accounts, and if they are terrible, it might impact the way that they rank that program. And if they're really great, it might make them rank the program higher. One thing that I think is important to note is that on average in 2025 now, so this data is old, on average in 2025, PGY1s are now Gen Z. I am a millennial. My co-residents are all millennials. We all know that Gen Z uses social media at a much higher consumption rate than we did, and not just a gradually higher consumption rate, at a massively higher consumption rate. So this data that says, you know, 50% say it influenced their impression and 30% says it influenced their rank is almost certainly going to skyrocket as these interns who are now Gen Z are more and more medical students are going to be applying from that generation. In a big study they did from Facebook, one third of adults get their news from social media. And 69% of those people were women. We all know we need more women anesthesiologists. And so if you're looking to have more women in your program, it can probably be safely said from the data that you should have a better social media presence and you may retain and recruit more female anesthesiology residents.
Yeah, very cool. And there's just no question that people are paying attention to this stuff. And especially in the era where there are no in-person interviews, and I get people asking me all the time, medical students asking me, how can I learn about these programs and decide where to send my signals? And I tell them, one thing is look at the social media, not because, you know, if they have a social media, that means anything, but you can get a feel. I mean, if it's always one person and they're just saying like, everything is great, you know, that's maybe a little concerning. But if you're seeing dozens of residents who are, you know, clearly engaged and enjoying things and maybe taking turns doing different videos and right. I mean, the fact that they're engaged in this means they care about the program, right? They feel good about the program or they wouldn't be doing it. And so that gives you a little bit of an insight that I think is really nice to have.
Yeah. And I think that one of the things that's important is the study's emphasis this as well is people really value transparency and they value authenticity. And I think from an admin perspective, it can be really tempting to have a social media account be very sterile. You might not show things that are hard. You might not show things that are messy. You might want it to just be for announcements and call schedules and ranking of your program nationally. I think I would very much so caution against that. If you have a very sterilized, admin-heavy Instagram, it's going to show that your program is maybe more sterile and admin-heavy. People are trusting that what they see is probably what they're going to get. I would also perhaps caution against having your Instagram be a meme page. I think this is really popular now where programs think that, you know, every video needs to be a viral, funny joke. I think that it's super fun to have occasionally, you know, some of those funny things. I think that it can increase your engagement in the short term. But when people click on your profile and all they see are jokes, they don't know what they're getting when they come. And I have really strived to ride that line between making it something that's engaging and something that's fun and something that people want to look at and they want to scroll through our posts, but making absolutely sure that what you see is what you're going to get. And I really hope that when you look at the Instagram page and you show up here on day one of orientation, you think, yeah, this is what it's about. This is what I thought it was going to be, and this is what it is. And I really think that that's the case. And I would advise anybody who wants to start a social media page to have that be your goal, to have it be what you see is what you're going to get. If that means sharing hard things that have happened, which I have had to do, that's good. And if something really great happens, don't forget to take a picture.
Absolutely. And the other thing is, what you've done an amazing job of is make sure people know, like, hey, I want pictures. So send them to me. And then that's really fun, right? Because it makes other people think, oh, I should make sure I get a picture of this to send to Alexis.
Yeah.
And that actually increases everyone's enjoyment of the things they're doing and feeling like they're participating too. What kind of things, Alexis, you know, you mentioned authenticity, trying to show what's really going on. So kind of what, give some examples of posts that you think are really good to try to shoot for.
Definitely. So one of the things that people really valued were videos of a day in the life. We've done a bunch of these on our page. We actually have a little banner up at the top that'll show you a couple of them. People want to know what you're doing day in and day out because they've never been a resident before if they're looking at your page. And so those types of videos get really good feedback. Posting social events shows that you're hanging out outside the hospital, your friends, people like seeing that. And then I think I touched on faculty interactions before. The program can't be a program without your teachers. And making sure that your teachers are engaged and showing how much they care for their residents, people really like seeing that as well. I'm very fortunate to have, you know, Jed Wolpaw himself texting me pictures from his call shifts. And it just makes me so happy to see that people want to remember things that are good. They want to share their good experiences with these faculty members. And that is also really important. So those are sort of three easy things to target if you are thinking about wanting it to be successful.
Yeah, awesome. Do you think, or do we know from the literature, are programs using social media in their kind of application screening period?
So it's interesting. It sort of goes both ways. So many programs now have a social media account. It very clearly shows that engagement in those accounts rises during application cycles. And so people will post more and have more interaction with their followers during the times where medical students are applying to residency. It also goes the other way, where the data does show that residency programs are looking at applicant social media as well. And even when I was a medical student back in the day, we were told you need to scrub your social media and make sure that it's all very kosher. I would caution you against removing all of your personality from your social media. I don't think you need to have a locked down private account and shut everything down, because I think we're actually going the direction where people want real life people to be at their residency program. I will say that if you have something that is divisive, or you're constantly posting things that are extremely negative, or you have an account that is sharing viewpoints that are, you know, against groups of people, you should take that down. You should definitely not have anything that's blatantly, you know, negative about yourself. But that does not mean that you can't post a picture of yourself at the beach. That does not mean that you can't show programs that you have kids. I think that if you are authentically yourself on social media, and in your interviews, you will match at a place that wants you to be yourself and doesn't want you to pretend to be somebody you're not. But the data shows that 40% of your program directors are going to look at your profile, no matter what. And about 17% have adjusted their rank lists based on your social media profile. And that's just people who admit to it. So it's probably higher. So just make sure that what you're posting is really you. And I think you'll be safe.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. Alexis, what an incredible trove of incredible advice we have gone over here. Anything that we didn't cover that you want to hit before we move on?
I think that I just want to say thank you for such an amazing residency experience. And I want to say good luck to all the people who are just starting. It has been such a blessing to see the CA1s come in for the very last time. I guess I can call myself an attending now because they're here. And I want to encourage you that I promise the process works. I promise.
Well, it has been, as I said up front, just an unbelievable pleasure to have you in the program. And the wisdom you have gained and put together and shared here today will help not only our incoming new residents, but new residents across the world. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. What would you recommend that the audience check out for fun?
Okay, I just discovered that there is an app called Hoopla, H-O-O-P-L-A. You log into it with your local public library account. So go to your public library, open up an account. I recommend everybody does this regardless. But if you log into Hoopla with your library account, you get thousands and thousands and thousands of free audiobooks. So you don't have to have an account with Audible. You can get very mainstream titles. Like I just listened to the ACOTAR series on there. They have every new and up and coming book, and I've gotten all of them for free just by having a public library account. So that is awesome.
That is awesome. Very cool. Yeah, couldn't recommend that more. The public library is, I feel like it used to be, I mean, I don't know. We used to not have the internet, right? So everybody used the library. But it's something that is, you know, I think maybe needs to be rediscovered. But my kids, I mean, when we take them to the library, they love it.
Love the library too.
Yeah.
Highly advocate for public libraries.
Public libraries, man. Absolutely. And I'm going to recommend a book that I got from my daughter who had to read it for school. She kind of had a few books to choose from for her English class, and she chose The Maze Runner by James Dashner. And she read, there are three books in the main kind of series, and then he then wrote two prequel books. So she just got hooked. She only had to read the first one for school, and then she read all three, and then she's now reading the prequel two. And so I thought, she was like, Daddy, you should read these. You know, they're not just for kids. And I said, well, tell me about it. It sounded interesting. So I now have read 2.5 of the first three. Very, very good, entertaining, interesting. It's dystopian novels, kind of remind me of The Hunger Games in some ways, but really interesting. And I would recommend for anyone interested in that kind of literature to check it out. And certainly they're pretty fast and easy reads.
I read those books as a teenager as well. I also loved them. And there's a movie, but the movie's not great. So just read the books.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't seen the movie. But easy to read. And I would say, you know, again, even as an adult. And then the other fun thing is if you have kids, and so my daughter who's reading them is 12, so that age-ish, certainly or older, I think fine. There's some parts that are a little scary, and she did, for some of them, have to decide not to read them at night because she was afraid she'd get bad dreams. But certainly something you could read along with your kid and kind of have fun doing that.
For sure.
Alexis, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Jed. I've absolutely loved it, and thank you again for the last 3 years.
Same to you. All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at Acrac Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACCRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Walpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Taylor Duggan, William Mao, and Rachel Furman are our production assistants and social media managers. Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Walpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along, which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.